Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice, the only podcast that tells you what's really happening in Seattle politics. But this week, the council's off, like, skiing or at the beach or whatever it is they do in December, right, Erica? C. Barnett of Publicola?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of them are, you know, planning their farewell parties, I assume.
Ouch.
Oh.
Well, maybe you're planning your farewell parties, Erica.
Apparently some of us are dancing on graves.
I'll be the first one at Erica's party, believe me.
We're here with our now once-in-a-lifetime annual tradition of making questionable predictions about what's going to happen in Seattle in the coming year, or talking about what we hope will happen in 2026, which is often the same thing. And Sandeep Kaushik, I'm going to start off by saying I expect to be just as wrong this year as I was last year when we did this.
Yeah. Well, I think being right is not the point.
Also with us this year, as he was last year, Josh Feit, who does communication for Sound Transit, was a co-founder of Publicola and is the co-author of a piece on Publicola with Erica C. Barnett titled A 14-Point Plan for Mayor Wilson. You can check that out on publicola.com. And Josh also at one time ruled over Sandeep and Erica at the Stranger with an iron fist.
Don't remind us. It was a dark period. It was a very dark period.
Josh, I just want to start by asking you, were either of those two good at meeting deadlines?
No.
These are lies. I always met deadlines.
Oh my God. We had a feature story assigned to Erica that never, Erica, I'm just going to say one word for you.
Denver. I eventually made Denver into something. There are a few infamous ones that, you know, are still percolating to this day. One of these days, Josh.
Yeah.
Look, a little ancient stranger history here. Before the days of slog, right, we would produce copy for the actual print paper. And so we had a deadline. I think it was Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. And we never turned in anything Tuesday morning at 9 a.m.
Well, that's because 9 a.m. didn't exist.
Yes, 9 a.m. was ridiculous. So we turned it in at like 11:30. And then they would, you know, and Josh would always berate us for not turning in the copy at 9 a.m. We were like, we didn't even start writing it. We start writing it at 9 a.m.
Boy. Sandeep came in at 11:30. Anyway.
That was the days when I slept till 9:30 for sure.
I feel proud that I'm able to open some old wounds.
Oh my God. My blood pressure is escalating.
As I mentioned, we're making predictions for 2026 or just talking about what we hope is going to happen next year. Sometimes it could be the same thing. And Josh, since you're our very special guest, I'm wondering if you could start with just one hope or prediction for 2026.
I mean, I'll make a prediction that Mayor Wilson is going to surprise her critics on the conservative side of Seattle spectrum, in that they're expecting a McGinn, they're expecting a Sawant, they're expecting a radical leftist agenda. And I will say she's got a leftist agenda, but I'll also say she knows how to get things done. She knows how to process information. She knows how to build relationships. She's smart AF. And she's serious. And I think people are going to be, I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised. I think the Times is going to be thrown off its heels as they try and sort of portray her as this diabolical lefty. And she's going to make progressives look good. That's my prediction / hope.
Yeah, a good one. I want to go to Erica next, but I just want to say, did you ever see the tweet from a few days ago where she met with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu? And the subhead was something about, you know, this is who to turn to figure out how to be an effective big city mayor. It sure seems like that's what she's intending to do, is to worry more about good governance than anything else. So yeah, fingers crossed.
I will say that the one overlay on that tweet, which I thought sort of contradicted what I said, or is sort of interesting, is that in the whole Mamdani comparison, you know, he's the one who made nice with Trump. And then the mayor of Boston criticized Mamdani for that, which was a more sort of righteous left position. So it was interesting to see that Wilson sort of embraced her as a model, given that she's taken sort of a, I don't know that people know that, and maybe she didn't know that, so I don't know. I might be reading too much into it. I think part of it is, you know, there's a feminist bond there. These are two women who are leaders of big cities now, so turning to her as opposed to Mom Donnie might just be sort of more of a sisterhood kind
let's
of thing.
Let's go to Erica right away, but like Michelle Wu is an incredibly effective, very popular mayor who just won re-election with like 75% of the vote. Her biggest opponent dropped out before the end of the race. And part of the reason she's been so successful is she's been very pragmatic and focused on good governance, just the way you were talking about. So I think Michelle Wu surprised people. And if Katie's saying she wants to follow in her footsteps, I mean, that could be a good thing. Erica C. Barnett, what do you think? Number one hope for 2026.
Number one hope. I mean, I guess I would hope that, and this is kind of going to our 14 points, my hopes are mostly around the police department and care. Katie Wilson decided to keep Police Chief Sean Barnes. And, you know, I understand that that's a very pragmatic move. We've talked about it, I think, before on the podcast. But, you know, what I would really like to see is some major changes happening that show a commitment to not just accountability at the police department, which I think is not something that we have really heard a lot about from Sean Barnes. That the city has been focused, the city council, the mayor under Mayor Harrell, and the police chief have really been focused on hiring more cops at any cost. And I think very much at the expense of things like hiring more women and like providing more accountability when police officers act poorly. And I think that goes, you know, a commitment to that and really pushing Sean Barnes on that, you know, as a kind of performance improvement plan, if you will, is really important. And it's something that I hope to see Katie Wilson do in the first 6 months. And hand in hand with that, I really want to see the care department, which has been sort of leashed in the latest police contract, which puts all kinds of restrictions on where they're actually allowed to respond to people. And, you know, and I hope they will figure out a way to renegotiate those terms because, you know, I've talked to Amy Barden, the head of care, and what she says is, you know, we are very committed to following the rules. And a lot of these folks, these social workers who work on this team are rule followers. They're not going to necessarily try to find ways around the rules that say that they can't respond to people if there's any kind of, you know, evidence of drug paraphernalia or any evidence that any crime has been committed, you know, or if they're inside any kind of structure that is in a public building. I mean, they're essentially, you know, they've been thwarted by the police a lot. I think that hasn't changed. And I don't think it's going to change unless the police department is sort of given a message that you can't jump on care and take their calls over. And unless they're actually allowed to respond to some calls that are in the kind of situations that they were created to respond to, because otherwise, I mean, you're going to get to a situation where the city's looking at the budget, they've added all this money for this care team, and they're hardly responding to any calls because they can't. And it looks like, you know, an automatic cut. I mean, it's kind of like the KCRHA, you know, declaring it a failure because they don't have enough money to solve homelessness. I mean, I don't predict that situation coming to pass, but I think it eventually will if the mayor doesn't, you know, and the police chief don't make some significant concessions and changes.
So to just piggyback on some of what Erica was saying, I think one of the things I will say I'm hopeful that this will happen more than I'm predicting that it will happen, is that in the arena of public safety and policing, that we will see, now that the officer count is starting to go up again at Seattle, that we will see a restoration or a return to efforts to actually do community policing in Seattle, right? I mean, I think the amount of community policing that was actually happening in the pre-pandemic period was pretty underwhelming, but it got completely, whatever little there was that was still happening, it got completely eviscerated during the pandemic era when numbers went down. And I'll give you a really specific example of this. This morning, we're taping on Thursday, I got a tour of King County Drug Court. They had invited me down. They know about my addiction history, blah, 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 blah. Like, lovely people, very interesting. I learned a lot. But one of the things, as I'm talking to the folks at Drug Court, they were telling me is, drug courts, there have been enormous numbers of studies done about the efficacy of drug courts, and there are best practices that have emerged out of that. And one of the best practices is that it's important to assign an officer or officers to be attached to drug court. And that officer does things like, if people stop showing up to drug court for their hearings, or, you know, aren't showing up for the treatment stuff they're supposed to do, the officer goes out and kind of corrals them, brings them back in and says, hey, come back to drug court. We need to get you back on the program and get back on the track. So they did this at King County Drug Court from the time it started in the 90s until 2020. It's really effective. Studies show it very significantly reduces the recidivism rate. It keeps people out of prison by having a cop attached to the drug court. But in 2020, they got rid of it. It was supposed to be a temporary thing because of staffing cutbacks. And it still hasn't come back, right? 5 years later. And so here's a case where take one cop, attach him to this court, and you can keep a whole bunch of people out of prison and in the kind of, you know, treatment and social services arena that the therapeutic court arena that would be really, really helpful for lots of people. So that's the kind of thing I hope we start to restore in Seattle in 2020.
Hey, Seattle Nice listeners. Seattle politics got you low. Well, get high with Uncle Ike's. Pissed at the mayor? Relax with a dollar joint. Pop a tire in a pothole? Eat a $2 gummy and chill. Whether you need something to pump you up for Saturday's protest or a mellow strain for your next sit-in, Ike's is your best friend. Now is the time to roll up, Seattle. Download the Ike's app today or head on over to Ike's.com. That's Ike's.com.
It seems like she's really indicating she's going to be focused on quality of life issues, and that includes making people feel safer and maybe being less thin-skinned when it comes to dealing with social media trolls and her critics on the left or the right. Let's hope that that's the way she chooses to govern and just focuses on good governance. But I want to start by predicting that the price of pizza is not going to go down in Seattle in 2026.
Boy, you're really obsessed with this.
I am totally obsessed. Despite what some Katie Wilson voters might be expecting, rightly or wrongly, based on her campaign advertising, because it's mostly not her fault. I mean, like, the price of stuff is just going to keep going up thanks to Trump's tariffs, whether you're, you know, importing fancy pizza ingredients or not. Trump's immigration policies mean a tighter labor market, and Seattle's costs, including wages, are high compared to almost every other city. So I don't really think any mayor could come in and significantly lower the price of something like pizza right now.
Well, to be clear, she was talking about housing affordability.
I know. But started lead, well, led I mean, with the $7 price of pizza.
So emblematic. Yeah.
I don't think any mayor is going to be able to significantly lower costs for things like pizza right now, but they could create policies that would raise costs. For example, like the minimum wage increases that we've had so far have been fantastic, but putting more pressure on wages without tip credits could increase the price of things like pizza and make the city less livable and less affordable for some, despite the fact that raising the minimum wage would be great. We should hopefully like have a clear and open and honest debate about the trade-offs about those kinds of policies.
Well, David, because I have good go news. We had that debate.
Because if you go to like, folks are talking about raising the minimum wage even more, and I think I probably support that, but we should talk about the trade-offs because that's going to further raise, you know, the price of pizza. And, you know, despite all of these costs going up, the rich are just getting richer. I mean, the top 10% are going to get richer under Trump thanks to his tax policies, and, you know, the tech bros in Seattle that still have jobs are going to be making even more money potentially with AI. And so people can pay a lot for a price of pizza and not really even feel it. And that's part of the reason why the price just keeps going up, because the demand for pizza seems to be infinite. And by the way, before I end this, I just want to ask if anybody's tried Post Alley pizza.
Not since it was the old Post Alley pizza back when I worked at Seattle Weekly in like 2001, but I hear it's great now.
It's so good.
Can I just say, David, first of all, I guess you agree with Trump on tip credit, and that's his populist answer. And I think that's a sort of a false populist notion. And so just want to throw that out there. I don't
make any assumptions. Like I said, I support the minimum wage increases we've had. I think we should have higher minimum wage. I just think we should have an open and honest conversation about the trade-offs, which are higher prices. That's one of the things that happens. And
the reason the tip credit got however many years, I mean, I think it was 10 years to take the tip credit away so that people who work for tips could actually make a minimum wage that's the same as everybody else in the city. 10 years passed, they got it. And I think that conversation happened. It should be over now. And, you know, and and people should get what we were promised.
Well, no, I mean, I'm talking about future minimum wage increases. We already have the one that we've had sort of baked in. The question is, is it going to go even higher? And I'm just saying. So Josh, do you want to respond to what anybody else said or bring up your next, or, and please, as a part of it, bring up your number two hope, fear, wish for 2026?
First, I just want to respond quickly and second what Sandeep said about community policing. I don't know if Sandeep, you're reacting to Mayor-elect Wilson's press release on, she did a recent press release where she stressed community policing as a big goal. So I think she agrees with you, and I think you're right. I think we're going to see a new emphasis on that.
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we will see some smart turns in how we do public safety.
And then I also want to respond to Erica in terms of, it was interesting, you know, that she did so far as not, she's retained Barnes, that decision. And I know that's frustrating for a lot of police accountability folks. It was interesting. The thing you always hear, you know, is that the new mayor comes in and they do make changes, and the first people to go are either the police chief or the first person to go is SDOT. And it does look like she has done that. And I'm not surprised given that her background is transit riders union, transit is her passion. So even in the context of what we're kind of saying about Katie, that she's pragmatic and she kind of wants to move gently and show that she's not a vengeful politician, she couldn't resist on transit, because that's where she's from. That's where mayors typically go. And I'm glad she did it. So,
well, and to be clear, what she did, just so listeners know, she replaced Adiam Emery, who was Bruce Harrell's pick, pretty recent pick for SDOT chief, and replaced her with Angela Brady from the Office of the Waterfront.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
And Angela's right now has the title of interim SDOT
director. That's right.
So what I didn't understand about that announcement was whether this is intended, that interim label is intended just because, you know, she's going to need to go through an appointment process, or whether they intend to make this a temporary thing and actually have a bigger search or something like that in the future. I didn't really get the clarity.
Although either way, it represents a change, but I was not surprised. And she's not shy is what I guess my point is, yes, she's clearly treading on a pragmatic approach, but she's not shy about sticking to her values. You know, I want to turn to our 14 points list. And I don't think this will happen, actually, but I would hope it would, because she noted it in her when she was differentiating herself on the campaign trail from Bruce Harrell on transportation policy, and she talked about congestion pricing. My hope is not a strict congestion pricing plan. What I wrote about on public poll is actually quite different, but it is prompted by congestion pricing. And I'd actually come up with a better term for it, which is a sprawl tax. In the piece, I called an urban pass, as kind of a cutesy way, riffing off the Washington pass. And that is to have people pay to come into popular parking zones, to pay for parking zones that exist because they are popular, dense, vibrant neighborhoods where their parking is supposedly a problem. And the urban pass would allow people a discount on that parking rate. It gets a little complicated. To keep the city whole, we would raise base parking rates so the city wouldn't lose its infrastructure money. Then here's my little twist on it, which is, and this is the kind of my bratty gotcha, the money that's raised from this urban pass would go back to a fund that would help build affordable housing and promote density in the places where these folks are driving in from. That is to say, and I'm being cute, but they clearly like density, but density exists as an offset for their kind of suburban lifestyles. So they're gonna come in.
You want us to build housing in Bellevue? Is that what you're
That's
saying?
That's right. We'll form a partnership. There will be a fund, and we'll build housing in Magnolia. I know Magnolia is dense. I can never come up with the neighborhood you want me to. But yes, it's sort of it's a gotcha.
I took Josh on a forced drive up Emerson, which turns into Manor on Magnolia, because I'm just like fascinated by it, because it was clearly all built in like the 60s and 70s. It's so dense with condo buildings, and like nobody knows it's there. It's crazy.
No one knows it's there. Anyway, I just say I'll wrap up the key. I know it's complicated. Just call it a sprawl tax, and people have to pay for getting the offset of urban neighborhoods offsetting their suburban lifestyles.
Erica C. Barnett, responses to Josh or anything you've heard today or in the last year, and your next hope, fear, prediction for 2026?
Well, as I told Josh as we were writing this, I feel like it's a little convoluted, but I like the spirit of it. I do think that, you know, I think we should, you know, get rid of restrictions on apartments everywhere in the city, and, you know, and let the demand decide. Cause man, I would love to have, you know, apartments and nightlife and all that kind of shit in my neighborhood, my undisclosed neighborhood, and bring it on. But yeah, I mean, I agree with the principle. And I think, Josh, just to add on to that, we were talking about doing like some kind of SUV tax. You know, maybe it's, and I was geeking out and saying maybe it should be, you know, based on gross vehicle weight, because, you know, SUVs really do, you know, actually contribute to the destruction of the streets. I mean, so does some of these giant electric pickups. So, you know, let's tax those.
Yeah. If you get a discount with the Urban Pass, you actually get a surcharge on your SUV. That
Yeah. And maybe I'm biased because I drive a Mini Cooper. But you know, I mean, my car is efficient. It takes up less space, you know, and it doesn't harm the streets as much. You know, because we're recording on a day when I just got back a response from SPD to my 10 outstanding records requests that I've been waiting on, some of which I've been waiting on since 2023. They now say that it'll be at the end of the year 2026 as my placeholder date for all of those. I got one record.
Are you serious?
Wow. So I have 10...
End of the year 2026. Yep.
And that's meaningless anyway, because I only got one record from SPD all year this year. All year. One document from 10 records requests. And so
I hope it's a good record.
It was a basic thing that they already have, and they gave it to me. I mean, it's outrageous. And so and this actually comes from the 14 points. I really think that we have lost transparency in our government in Seattle. And I think it's been a slow process. It accelerated during COVID, but it started, you know, and my marker in my mind is when Jenny Durkin took the city directory offline so that now you can't get city employees' phone numbers and emails, which is standard at the state. It's standard, or, you know, much of the state. It's standard at King County. Seattle is an outlier. But Durkin decided this wasn't important. Nobody has ever replaced it. And it just goes into every single agency has become, you know, within the city has become less transparent. SPD is the worst. And I think they're breaking the law, you know, on public disclosure, because they are completely obstructionist. And, you know, we keep expanding the public disclosure unit. It doesn't get any better. But I think that we just, you know, we need a mayor who's actually focused on transparency, particularly for SPD. And I'm gonna be writing this week about, you know, calling for an audit of SPD's public disclosure unit, because there was an audit 10 years ago and it's only gotten worse. And I know, like, I get very righteous about this shit because I'm a reporter, but I believe that the public should be able to access public records. But we've just had mayors over and over who don't give a shit about this. And you know, and I hope Katie Wilson, you know, and all the other things that she's going to be working on will find some time to give just a little bit of a shit about this, and, you know, and start holding press briefings, you know, that are sort of open to any subject, bring back the city directory, and, you know, and really put some pressure on SPD to start being more transparent. I mean, they used to put police reports online. And now I tried to get police reports this week and they told me to file a records request, which is an exact synonym for fuck you.
I mean, we used to have a reporter at The Stranger, Charles Mudaty, who had a regular column where he'd go weekly and pick up the police reports.
Yep.
And the, with,
police
I mean,
beat. Yeah.
Yeah. Which was poetry and the greatest.
It was the greatest thing ever. I had the privilege of editing that column and it was poetry, but my God, I had no idea, Erica, that's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, it's so crazy.
I think there's no question that transparency and accountability at the city has atrophied in recent years. I actually, Erica's going to disagree with me on this. I actually think the work from home stuff has not helped there. But yeah.
I mean, as somebody who, like, I don't think that that the work that they're doing in the public disclosure office actually has anything to do with whether they're chatting over the water.
Well, it's also harder to get a hold of people and they're not showing up to, you know, and people are fucking off at home and stuff like that. But like, you know, like on the clock, right? And that's
yes, I'm
not
sure that the police
either.
Were never fucking off before work from home came to be.
I'm with you on the police stuff. I like that they're unresponsive to you is bad. Like I'm 100% with you on that.
Sandeep, is that your prediction for 2026? More employees are fucking off from home, or fewer, or you've got something else?
No. I mean, I will say like that it's going to be, you know, the one really, really smart play on the part of the city employee union. They were the earliest union and really the only union before the big union before the primary to endorse Katie. Right. They backed her and they're the head of it was a leader on her transition team and stuff like that. And that's so they've definitely gained sort of political prominence out of their, you know, political decision-making in this campaign for what that's worth. No, here's my prediction I will make for 2026, which is that I think the biggest fight the incoming mayor is going to have in year 2026 are going to be not with the center and not with the business community, but with certain elements of the left. For exactly the reasons, Josh, that you were talking about, she's coming in as a get things done pragmatist. She's putting a lot of weight on that. She wants to actually deliver some tangible results. And in order to achieve some of these things, like, for instance, her pledge that she would like to add, you know, she wants to get 4,000 unsheltered people into shelter or housing by the end of her first term. But she's also said before the World Cup, she wants to move a significant number of people into shelter over the next 6 months. And to do that requires moving dollars around. And if she's really serious about it and does it, and I will applaud her if she does, but that will require doing some stuff that certain elements of the left are going to push back on her on. You know, her fight's not going to be with the Downtown Seattle Association or the Chamber of Commerce. It's going to be with some of the housing people. So anyway, I think that could be emblematic of several fights that happen in 2026 if she actually moves on a kind of results-oriented, you know, kind of new progressive model.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Katie Wilson could do that I think would be risky, I don't know about, not with the left, but just with sort of the way stuff is done in the city, is, you know, the city council this year said that she has to spend all the money on the unified care team, which is the encampment removal team that has just is so bloated now. It includes, you know, cops. It's 116 people. And Bruce Harrell just increased it throughout his term. What I would do if I were her is figure out a way, you know, in collaboration with City Attorney Erica Evans, to repurpose that money so that it is still being used for something called the Unified Care Team, but that actually provides care and that actually directs people into shelter. I mean, when I don't know the exact dollar amount because the UCT is sort of hidden all over the budget, but it's 116 people. That's a small department. And I think that money could obviously be better spent than the way it's being spent now, which is just moving people around. I mean, you know, I see up in Ballard all the time, the same people just getting moved from literally around the same block over and over all year, you know, and that's a waste of money. And Wilson said it was a waste of money on the campaign trail. So figure out a better way to spend that money.
I kind of agree with Sandeep that her fights might be with the left. And that does kind of echo what I was saying. I just wonder about how this is going to play out for the council. You know, you've got a mayor that's coming in that has clearly allied herself with the new elected, Eddie Lynn and Dion Foster, and also already on the council, Alexis Mercedes Rink. So, they're kind of seeing themselves a block. It's interesting to me, and Erica might have more insight into this, as to what's going to become of the kind of mods and conservatives on the council who've been running the show and find themselves kind of, I think, the narrative right now with Katie as mayor is playing more to the progressives on the council, and they're going to be setting the agenda. That's going to be a totally new story out of fourth floor. If I'm getting the floor right, Erica.
Second floor. Second you're thinking floor. Of second, old City Hall, floor. I think.
I am thinking of old City Hall. Yeah. Sorry, cut that because I don't know.
No, leave it in.
2001. Was that the last time you visited City Hall, Josh?
So I do think it's going to be interesting to see. And I do see my prediction. You know, I don't think this is a very startling thing to say. I think Alexis is going to really emerge as a leader on the council along with Dion. Dion brings some serious brain power. And does Eddie Lynn, already impressive. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. With Katie, is Katie going to find herself at odds with some of the progressives on the council or is she going to, are they going to stand by her and stick with her and sort of make her goal of a successful progressive governance model work? You know, are they going to see that as more meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the most progressive member of the council, you know, in recent years has been Alexis Mercedes Rink. And I think she's also been very pragmatic, you know, in her her votes, her support, her, you know, she partnered with Bruce Harrell on on a new tax increase on big businesses. So, I mean, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if people like Bob Kettle, you know, still get up there and give their speeches about the permissive environment and how we're all, you know, aligned against you know, allowing sort of the aesthetic trappings or the aesthetic impacts of crime to proliferate. I mean, it's just going to be a different day when that's not sort of a lockstep position of most of the council.
I guess we'll see. I mean, is she a carceral leaning socialist in some ways or not? I'd be curious to see how well she gets along with Bob Kettle on issues like quality of life. I was just thinking about when you were all working at The Stranger and I first moved here, it was a kind of a weird city to move to because you were all obsessed with the monorail and it was never really going to happen.
We were just talking about it yesterday. Yeah.
But you know what
you're
I kind of
obsessed with
what
the monorail.
I loved about it was like Seattle just was dreaming of shit like that, dreaming of like putting cable cars in and just dreaming of like what a cool city it could be. And when McGinn got elected, there was a lot of that promise, that kind of optimism about what cities could become. And I hope my hope for Katie Wilson is she's able to bring some of that energy and deliver on some of that. I think unfortunately for McGinn, he got too obsessed with trying to kill the tunnel and then he was facing some tough economic times. And so we got a lot more bike lanes and stuff like that. But I think that he didn't fully deliver on the vision. And there just hasn't been as much talk about a green car-free city as we used to have. It was just the main focus of politics back then. There's been less of a focus on that. So I'm hopeful, you know, that we get more of that back. I don't know, like maybe gondolas for poorer surrounding neighborhoods to be able to go up to Finney Ridge to visit Sandeep like they have in Medellin, yeah. Colombia. Something like that would be good.
The gondola.
That's one.
My Che Guevara loving neighbors are going to fight the
gondola.
I think
I know which that's neighbors you're talking about, Sandeep. I hear there's some dueling yard signs up there.
So Josh, back to you. There's been some back talk. There's been some reactions, but do you want to give us your third bold prediction for 2026 or just hope or fear, apocalyptic fear about what might happen?
I'm going to tack back to our 14 points so I hope that Katie read it and we'll follow our agenda. But no, this one is...
And you'll denounce her if she doesn't.
That's right. But, you know, this one is one of the ones I put on there, which I call funded inclusionary zoning. We've got these two things in play right now in Seattle to create more affordable housing, which is inclusionary zoning, which essentially says developers have to include affordable housing in their developments or pay into a fund in lieu of. And, you know, it's a money loser for them. And then we have this other program, the MFTE program, which gives developers a tax rate if they choose to put affordable housing in their units. So I'm saying FIZ, funded inclusionary zoning, and this works in Portland. They've stood this up in Portland. The first report is looking pretty good. So yeah, I just think that's the way to go. I think, you know, Sandeep, if she wants to win some points with moderates or the right, you know, this is a tax break for developers, for dreaded developers, right? But you know, I'm for it. Like, why would we put a tax on or make more expensive something that we want? We want more affordable housing. Developers can build it for us. Let's give them a tax break. Let's make them do it and let's fund it. Let's subsidize it. So funded inclusionary zoning come from a property tax. I will say there's something in play in Olympia that's also this year that's along these lines, which is make sure I get this right, Erica, a land fee tax.
I think it's a land value tax.
Land value tax, which would also sort of prompt or incentivize landowners to not just sit on things like parking lots and build more useful things like affordable housing.
Oh, you know what? I think it might be a land use tax. Josh, you know more about this than I do, so I shouldn't have.
It's not a land use tax. It's a land value tax. You're right.
Well, read Publicola for more once we figure out what it is and start writing about it.
Yeah. Whatever it is, we should do it. Whatever they call.
Erica C. Barnett.
Well, I'm gonna steal a point from our 14 points that Josh actually wrote, but I think we both came up with it. Speaking of, you know, evil greedy developers, let's help out some evil greedy businesses by actually incentivizing businesses that stay open at night. Previous efforts in this city under Durkin and Harrell to incentivize, you know, what they think of as like late night businesses, which I guess in Seattle means anything after five, have been like so anemic and almost embarrassing. It's been like, you know, maybe like one day a week or one day a month in Pioneer Square, people can walk around with wine and go from business to business at from 5 to 7. And it's like, you know, it's so embarrassing that, like, you know, we are a growing and pretty large city, and we have, you know, essentially, like, other than, you know, the quote-unquote club district or whatever they're calling Capitol Hill in the comprehensive plan, the Capitol Hill nightlife district, you know, I mean, the city is just dead after 10. And I'm not just talking about bars and clubs, although the comprehensive plan does not allows businesses in neighborhoods, but it explicitly says no bars. You know, it allows restaurants, but they have to close at 10. It allows shops, but they have to close at 10. I think we should be providing some sort of incentive, whether it's, you know, a tax incentive, whether it's actual financial support to stay open during hours when initially there might not be that much business. The places that stay open, you know, I don't know what the hour is, 8, 10, you know, and actually serve people who have jobs during the day, might want to go to the corner store at 11 o'clock at night, you know, might want to go to the 12 o'clock, you know, in the morning pizza place, and they don't live on Capitol Hill. And this is part of bringing density to neighborhoods, too. I mean, I would love to have a convenience store across from my house. I used to have one. Actually, the last two places I lived, I had one. I don't now. And so, yeah, I mean, incentivize businesses to stay open actually late and all the time, not just like on our cutesy little like neighborhood art walks that we decide are, you know, okay under sanctioned controlled conditions once a month. You know, let's actually be a city.
Yeah. And real quick to jump on this real quick, this dovetails with actually creating a whole nighttime economy. This is called a concept known as the nightmare. And it's not only about businesses and nightlife and entertainment. It's about 9 to 5 people that need to get shit done in the evening. So it's keeping services open late. It's about nighttime workers and having more night owl bus service. So it's not just about bars and restaurants. It's about kind of envisioning a city that functions at night, which I think would make it an easier city for people to live in.
I will say that when I first moved here in 2001, I lived in Ballard and it was dead. It was so dead at night, except that right where I lived behind the Sunset Bowl. And I called it the 24-hour corner because there was the Sunset Bowl, which I think was 24 hours.
It was.
There's the Denny's with karaoke and, like, you know, it had like a whole bar scene. Like, there's a bar at the Denny's. There was two 24-hour, I think the Safeway and Ballard Market were both 24-hour. And then there was, like, you know, a bunch of 24-hour fast food places just all kind of on this corner. And, like, that area has nothing 24-hour anymore.
That's a good point.
So in a weird way, we're, like, going backwards.
Going backwards. I think even the 7-Eleven near my house closes at, like, 10:30.
Yeah.
Sandeep Kaushik.
Ridiculous.
late night Seattle, what's your fondest wish for 2026 to close it out?
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, maybe we should actually make a crown for the nightlife czar of Seattle, the long-serving Scott Pluskalic. Sorry, I'm mispronouncing Scott's last name.
Sure, everybody does.
But Scott's been doing the nightlife czar thing, I think, going back to the Ed Murray days, if I'm remembering right, doing nightlife stuff. So anyway, shout out to Scott. He's great. You know, I made this prediction other places, or not a prediction, but a comment where, I do think this dovetails with the 14-point plan, whatever the hell you guys, a 14-point manifesto or demand letter that you sent to Katie Wilson, or whatever the fuck it is.
14 points of blackmail, something.
Yeah. It does feel to me like that 2025 really did feel to me like it was like the last stand of lesser Seattle NIMBYism. And that I do think there's going to be a big turn where the politics of the city and of City Hall will catch up with where the voters have been moving towards more openness to density, to stuff like you all are talking about, nightlife, things like that. And I do think that, you know, I would be surprised if the new mayor doesn't try to go big on the second part of the comp plan, right? You know, bringing back some of the neighborhood centers that Bruce Harrell pulled out of the original proposal put together by the planners. So I think those kinds of conversations about embracing growth and density seem like they're primed to sort of take off in this new dispensation we have in 2026 in a way that I just think they've been lagging behind the shift in public sentiment.
Are you basing that on election results or what? I love that hope or prediction, Sunday, but what's that?
Yeah. I mean, that's why I asked Katie when she came on Seattle Nice a few weeks ago, if she calls herself the urbanist mayor, and she totally embraced that label, like along with the socialist mayor, right? Everybody calls her the socialist mayor. And I'm like, aren't you the urbanist mayor? Are you the urbanist mayor? And what does that mean to you? And she had a really good answer on that. She said, yes, I'm the urbanist mayor. And, you know, she has an explanation of a vibrant, you know, action pack, live fill city. That's one of the markers she's putting down of what she wants to create in the city. And I think if she moves in that direction, it will be a political win for her, you know, a fairly broadly based political win. There is a rump of kind of older boomer Seattle that is still kind of, you know, is pining for, you know, does not want to lose the last vestiges of kind of, you know, and it may have been great, but the old kind of provincial small town Seattle, right? And there's great deep nostalgia for that and fear of change and growth and the problems of that. And so those folks are vocal, but they're a shrinking minority of the city. So it's not just her election, but, you know, I think, you know, not to, you know, I hear rumor. I guess, should I say this out loud here?
Yeah, say it out loud.
From what I hear, the scuttlebutt on the street, and caveat this, if you will, in the council reorg that happens every time a new council comes in, I'm hearing Eddie Lynn is likely to take over land use, that committee. So I think, you know, he's got a housing background. I think he kind of codes as an urbanist. So I think we'll see stuff happen on that front, right? I think Dion Foster, you know, is going to be amenable and open to that kind of stuff. And so I do think we're likely to see a palpable shift.
Hilariously, the District 3 council member, Joy Hollingsworth, which you would think would be the district that would be sort of all in on this urbanism, is one of the most conservatives on this issue. So it'll be interesting to see how she plays it.
Yeah, and look, and maybe I'm overstating. This is a divided council, right? We're no clear majority. I mean, I think the conventional wisdom is that you got a 3-3-3 kind of council. Like,
I think that it really shows that there was a huge lost opportunity for the NIMBYs or the sort of NIMBY adjacent people, because, and it's Bruce Harrell's fault. He delayed so long on the comp plan that now a lot of it is still open as these new progressives are coming on the council. Had he actually managed to like get off his ass, get it done, and get it, you know, out the door and through the council, I mean, I think we would be having a very different conversation. But there's a ton of stuff that's still on the table, you know, including zoning, that that now this new council and new mayor are going to get to take up. And I think it's a real opportunity for those of us who identify as urbanists. But, you know, the NIMBYs could have had like basically everything they wanted, but they didn't act.
That's a great point, Erica. The Harrell legacy, his delay on density is going to, you know, develop density. He, you know, going to bite him.
Thanks, Bruce.
Well, all right. I want to close it out with the third leg of the real progressive urbanist school, which is making sure that cities have high quality public education. I bring it up because in other big cities, real cities, schools are run by city government. So when there's a mayor's race, people talk about the public schools and how they're doing. And by and large, that creates more accountability and often better results. Whereas our public school system is like the local section of the paper, like in the town that you've never been to. And 95% of people in Seattle, I'm guessing, or more, couldn't name the people who serve on the Seattle School Board, let alone what they're actually doing. And if you look at academic performance when it comes to basic competency, we're not doing very well in Seattle compared to other places, including Mississippi, Erica, which is embarrassing for us. Good for Mississippi, but bad for us. So my prediction is that the results don't lie. Like, ultimately, the data doesn't lie. And people in blue cities, including Seattle, are going to start talking more about the quality of our education system and how to actually improve that instead of all the other bullshit culture war stuff that we've been talking about. Not that it's complete bullshit, but we spend too much time on that, too little on quality of education. I'm ranting about it. And I really hope that we see people talking about a city takeover of Seattle public schools, because I think until that happens, we're going to continue to have no accountability for our public education system. And that's my rant for 2025.
I will just comment on this really quickly. I don't know about mayoral control of Seattle schools or city control of Seattle schools. It's been a traditional third rail in city politics. It may still be a third rail. That said, I totally agree with you, David, that the state of the schools is pretty shitty and in Seattle. And for all of this like highfalutin talk about equity this or equity that, the results of the Seattle schools are really, really inequitable right now. And I do think, as I've been involved in some school stuff, that I feel like there's kind of a Seattle school, public school parent rebellion kind of brewing on this. There's a lot of anger about the poor performance of the Seattle schools, the opaqueness and non-responsiveness of the district, right, which puts even the city to shame. I actually think we saw those in some of the school board races and some of what happened in these races and some of the people who won. So maybe there's change coming. There's a new superintendent. There's some new school board members. But I do think that's a sleeper issue.
I will say real quick on this too, and I'll be brief. I don't think we're going to take over this. That issue's been being kicked around forever. It never happened. I will say one place that can have a direct impact is, you've heard of transit-oriented development. I call for school-oriented development. The best performing schools are in the single family, traditionally the residential single family zone neighborhoods. Let's build densely and allow working class folks and people that need multifamily around schools. So it's sort of like SOD programs.
They have access to better schools and better education.
Yeah. You do is you build, school oriented density. I think is one place the city can have an impact as Erica called for, reopen the comp plan, and let's get that in there. Let's get SOD in there.
I love that. So palpable shift to urbanism, probably not going to get a takeover of Seattle public schools anytime soon, but I'm hoping. Several points from Publicola's 14-point plan, which I'll put in the show notes, but of course you can just find it on publicola.com. It's the 14-point plan, but I was thinking some folks on Twitter are actually calling it Project 2026. Have you guys seen that?
No. On what website? You say it's called...
You get my joke.
Twitter.
All right. Project 2025. Anyway, so that's it for another edition of Seattle Nice. He is Josh Feit. She's Erica C. Barnett. He's Sandeep Kaushik. I'm David Hyde. Our editor is Quinn Waller. And thanks, everybody, so much for listening.